This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Welcome along to Reality Check Radio with Marie. You're with Counterculture. I'm so thrilled to have back on the show Daniel Principa, youth advocate and educator from Australia. I can't believe, it's been over a year. Where's the time gone, Dan? How are you?
Yeah, it's been a year, and thankfully we've got lots to report on after a year, which is good. I'd be more concerned if a year had passed and it's kind of like nothing's changed and we haven't seen great progress in this space of advocating for young people and engaging boys. So yeah, at least we can catch up today with some good things to talk about.
Well, let's start with the big good thing. And I know that you're probably not, well, you want to talk about it, but you're going to be humbled by it, of course, is your nomination for New South Wales Australian of the Year. You must have been like, whoa.
Yeah, I kind of thought it was a bit of a G-up. I thought someone was kind of playing a prank on me. I was actually overseas enjoying life in Europe and kind of got the call. And my response was like, oh, yeah, like me and probably 30,000 other people have been nominated too, which is the case. And they said, oh, no, you're down to the final four people. And that was certainly pretty humbling, and especially alongside the incredible women that were nominated as well. Some of them, yeah, people that I had admired from a distance and some up close. So one of them I actually quote in my work occasionally, Jess Hill. So, yeah, that was pretty special and so wonderful to spend time with them and celebrate all our different, you know, perspectives and stories. Yeah.
And also, too, it's an acknowledgement of the advocacy work that you do for young men, because that's something we talked about last time, and I think it is something that is, I worry for our young men. I mean, I was telling you about because of course I've got two teenage sons now, 16 and 18, and you know, we want to do the best by our young men. So what's changed from when we caught up last time to now? How are you seeing things? How is the mood, the psyche of our young men that you're seeing in Australia?
It's great that you asked that question. And I actually think the first thing I want to speak to is that what I've noticed changing is how the media and other advocates, and I'm not saying they've only just started or it's because of what I've said. I mean, heck, there's wonderful people out there thinking really wisely about this and looking at both research and the pragmatics of engaging with young men. But one of the things that I'm really pleased to see from kind of mainstream culture and talking about this is people recognizing that boys are wanting to do good. They're trying to make sense of their circumstances and that it's not all bad. And it seems so obvious to say that, but of course, and I always say this, and it's terrible that you always have to hold these things in tension. It's like, yes, I am very well aware of what happens when men don't respect their masculinities, their sexuality, and their place and strength and power in the world. And it goes awry. Absolutely. Like, I am very, very aware of that as much as you possibly can be in a lot of senses. However, I think so many boys especially are just trying to work it out. And I've loved that the tone of media coverage is like, how do we work with them, not just talk at them or, you know, be didactic in our approach or shaming them, but actually like leaning in and having conversations with them. And I'm really pleased to see other advocates who are at the coalface engaging with boys or thinking well about the research are recognizing like, we've got to talk with them. Like, we've got to meet them where they're at. Try as best as we can as adults to make sense of their worlds. And like, as I say, the mixed messages they get about being a man, about relationships, about sex, about what success should look like, you know, like what are we even saying about that? And I love that there's been a bit of a shift, and some of the research that's come out this year as well has confirmed what I've seen on the front lines working with about 10,000 boys this year, is that they're not all just like obsessed with toxic influences and pornography and that they all think online gaming chats are like great. They're critically thinking about it. And I think so much of our assumption is that like every young boy is just obsessed with all these harmful, toxic, unhealthy habits or traits, when that's not the case. They exist, and they exist more in the cultural, social expectations that boys feel pressured to conform to. But does the average boy actually want or think like that? No, like I'm not convinced of that. And that's what I see. I see so much of it as more performative, but I've got to have just the most incredible conversations with young men this year who want to be loving, want to be respectful, want to be courageous. They want to be that bloke who sets a good example for their mates, for their younger siblings. But it's like, well, how do you do that? And let's be honest, I didn't wake up like that. And I certainly still aren't now. Like, I'm still becoming, you know, it's still that journey. And so, yeah, that's been the great shift. And I think boys themselves are hopefully going to experience that from the adults in the room that are there to champion them. And I certainly think that, yeah, these conversations aren't for everyone. Like, you know, and I recognize some people talking to a room of teenage boys is hard for them, confronting for them. And if that's the case, then like make space for other people who are kind of happy to deal with the complexities of it all and work with them. And I always use the language of like a gracious curiosity, you know, like to just help them make sense of their own world. You can't be reactive and offended. And you want boys to feel safe to ask questions about all sorts of things, because otherwise they'll go into online spaces. So yeah, that's a long-winded answer to say there's definitely been a positive shift. And I think people are realizing we have to get out of sort of academic jargon and actually get into real-world conversations with boys. Like, learn from what the research is saying, listen to academics, but some of that language does not translate on the front lines of engaging with boys.
Mm. Interpersonal in-person relationship and mateship is something that I've seen with the group of friends that my sons have, and their ability to be able to just do what boys naturally do, have banter, have joshing, have all of that sort of stuff. And I think that that's part of that fabric of camaraderie, isn't it? And for somehow that seemed to, it got lost for a while, and I'm seeing it starting to come back. How is social media? Because in Australia at the moment, you've had a bill that's introduced looking to ban social media for under 16s. Now, I've got some opinions on this. I would like to get your thoughts on this. Do you think that the bill is a goer? Is it something that should happen, would happen, could happen? And if it were to happen, how on earth would you encourage boys to stay off social media?
Yeah, it's a huge question, isn't it? There's so much to unpack on this. I just got asked about it when I was speaking at the Department of Education in Western Australia this week. And, you know, my thoughts is I have reservations for different reasons, right? And I also have sympathy towards why this is needed. At the end of the day right now, there are significant harms because of social media, recognizing that academics have different views and there's groups of academics who have disagreed with that. Something that I hold to is that I think a lot of people who are completely against the ban, not for freedom of speech, freedom of information reasons, which again is a huge complex conversation, but some of the ones that are against it because they're oblivious to the harms, that's something that I get quite defiant towards, because I'm seeing every day the impact and speaking at the coalface with the young people themselves, their parents, their educators who see firsthand the impacts. And sometimes I see a little bit of snobbery that's kind of like, well, if it's not academic, you know, peer-reviewed research, then that's not true. And it's like, well, what do you do with the fact that we have reported increased, you know, child-on-child harms to do with sexualized behaviors? What do you do with the language and the trends that are clearly online that become in the real world, right? And some of this is happening faster than the research can keep up with it, that you hear about on the front line. So I definitely have a disposition that says I'm not convinced that a lot of the people who are flippant about this, I think they really haven't set with the pain and the tragedy. And sometimes it's easy to kind of hide behind research. And I say this even about me, where you're not sitting with the actual emotional carnage and harms being done to young people. You know, for example, there's research on how many young people have been approached by a predator, a catfisher, sextortion online. And it's horrific when you know those numbers. Now, that's not me then saying let's go ahead with this piece of legislation. I just want to say, can we rightly sit with where we're at right now as a society and how we got here in terms of the harms and the impact of social media? Fascinatingly, when I ask young people to, and again, it's not peer-reviewed research, but tell me, like, what do you think? Is this more of a net good or net like unhealthy for you? Or most young people say it's definitely unhealthier for them. Like they recognize that they're spending way too much time on this. They joke, the boys especially, about brain rot, which is all the nonsense, inane things that they laugh at that are just meaningless. And so that's on the more milder vanilla end of the spectrum in terms of harm, in terms of just lost hours, you know, just how much nonsense is being shared, wasted time that they could be putting into their talents, their skills, their ambitions, these sorts of things. I recognize there's a social component of it, and it's not all bad. It's a way that we connect. But when you start to look at some of the darker things that have been enabled by social media, that, let's be honest, these trillion-dollar companies have put very little effort into actually stamping out or curbing, I'm just not convinced that they're going to come to the table, because they haven't. Like, safety by design is just a nice policy phrase that we throw around that has not actually underpinned how these platforms have been built. So the question is, like, in my mind, yeah, I ideally young people could be on social media if we had a culture where more parents were engaged in keeping them safe, putting parameters, boundaries around it, making sure young people had other outlets, both socially, emotionally, relationally, to connect. And if big tech was held to account. But that's not happening on the individual community scale. People have kind of just, it's the Wild West out there, and parents, like, the genie's out of the bottle, and parents are like struggling to know what to do. So we've got that on one side, on the individual, personal, taking responsibility. So we need a cultural shift there. And then on the other side, we have trillion-dollar big tech who is completely indifferent and has not been dragged to be held to account on this. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I spoke to the Australian, some senators recently at Parliament House, and I said, you know, there was a Nudify app on the App Store where any young person could download it and within moments be creating deep fake pornographic images of anything or anyone they knew, and that was set to the ages 4 and upwards, right? So yeah. I'm not saying that the young person should be punished. Yeah, they need some education and consequences for using it, but the fact that that could even be created and uploaded and approved on the Apple Store without consequence, like, that's where the consequences need to be. But the reality is this is all happening, and it seems to be like only until someone complains, challenges it, that we see some reaction. So it's not safety by design. So trillion-dollar tech is not being held to account. Mm-hmm. So my question is, culturally, yeah, we need a bit of a shift, and big tech needs to be held to account. And I kind of feel like this has just been the easier, more simple, low-hanging fruit to address both of those. And in it, big tech in the legislation is held to an account. It's, again, who's going to implement that? There's a two-year review. I met with a senator this week to talk through some of the details. And again, I'm not across it. There's other people that are, that, you know, go seek their opinions. And there's a review in it. There's kind of provisions in terms of privacy and not having to upload IDs and all of that, which I too have slight, you know, reservations about. I guess my biggest point is, have we really diagnosed the harms, and are people really sitting with that? And then, yeah, ideally big tech and parental, cultural, social change would happen so that we don't have to go down this path. That is my ideal preference. However, we're here sitting with this going, well, what do we do?
I mean, I look at it as political point scoring. I think you're right, low-hanging fruit from a political perspective. And also, too, it solves a problem for governments. I mean, governments have been wanting to issue in some form of state-regulated digital ID for ages. And I mean, they failed during COVID, but this would be the perfect opportunity because everyone...
This could be. Yeah, this could be. I'm less concerned about that, I must admit. Like, I'm less concerned. I think for me, the best counter argument in this space is like, well, given it's actually about the harmful content, because social media in and of itself isn't harmful. Using it, I mean, you could argue in some senses, you know, if it's proportionate more than real world interactions and developing other skills and hobbies, then maybe, depending on time usage. But for me, it's actually about the harmful content, which is the predators, the pornographic material, the violent material. So I saw research recently that something like upwards of 90% of children in the UK, like teenagers, not children, but like had seen a beheading, right? So again, I'll have to find that stat. But, you know, you look at that with the pornography, which is increasingly violent, and it's like, well, passing legislation on pornography would have been a great first step. Like in my mind, that is far more urgent because so much of the harms on social media is this kind of content. And some people know the Children's Commissioner report from the UK found that most porn is accessed on X, on Twitter, you know, like by young people. That's actually the number one. So there's a sense of addressing those kinds of harmful content for me is probably more urgent. And then we can look at, well, how do we hold big tech to account so that young people aren't being sextorted, that cyberbullying and threats to kill each other, like it could actually somehow, you know, be safety by design or have some sort of process in that. I don't know. I'm not a tech person, but.
So here's my issue with all of that, right? Well, it's not an issue actually, because I know it can be done. And the reason I know that it can be done is they've been doing it from a political and ideological standpoint with using AI and algorithms for the last 5 years. So if got someone that politically that they don't agree with, they will shadow ban you, they will bury it, they will do all of these things to actually prevent that content going into a space. We saw it during COVID. So why not apply that to those people providing
explicit content? I agree with you. And that's exactly right. That should be so easily to discern and then respond to, because the capacities are there. And other professors like Professor Galloway in the US said, like, you know, like these social media companies can actually know how you're feeling, what's going on in your life by how you're accessing social media and what you're doing. And there's no doubt that they have the data and the capacity to do so. It's just holding that to account. So I would rather government use their power to hold that $1 trillion empire to account as best as that's possible. That would be in an ideal outcome. But I think the biggest thing is like who's advocating on behalf of young people in terms of the harms. And there is a disconnect between what the average person kind of knows in terms of the young person's experiences online and what they assume. And so I think for me, I want to diagnose the problem more effectively and faithfully and recognize, where are the harms occurring and then what we could do about it. So, I think is the ongoing challenge as well.
Yeah. And the other side with a blanket ban as well. I mean, you work with young men all the time. I've got to do with them in this house. The minute you tell them that they can't do something, they want to do it.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's just human nature, isn't it? So we've been writing about that for thousands of years. And the other thing I always keep in mind, and I've said this at my recent parent community events, is at the end of the day, they're going to be 18 and we have to actually equip them as best as we can, just like no one's fully equipped to work their first job at 18 or whenever. But at the same time, we have to equip them to a degree that they're going to be 18, have access to the whole of the internet. And what are they going to do? So there is still a sense of we have to equip them for that and to make the best decisions possible. And it's just a matter of how do we actually achieve that.
So I saw a study that was saying that the 18-year-olds of today, so mine turned 18 in the middle of the year, 18-year-olds of today, from a maturity and ability to lead adult lives and into the independent living away from their families, are running at 2 to 3 years less than what they were, say, when I was 18 in the early 90s. So then how do we prepare them? So how do we get these young men ready for the big wide world?
It's true. And that is, you've raised something that people have observed from Jonathan Haidt to Gene Twinge, who are a couple of academics in the US who have observed this delayed kind of maturation that we're seeing. And obviously lots has shifted in our culture and people will point to the fact that, we get married and have children later in life. Like people kind of get their first professional jobs later in life. And there's clearly bigger systemic reasons why. It's not because people don't necessarily want to. It's like, well, right now with cost of living, housing, affordability, it's like these sorts of steps. I know even for my friends who are, that 10 years older than, say, that who are like, I want to make these big life decisions, but it is getting harder. And so there is that need to, do we stay at home longer? Do we need these assurances and kind of quote unquote safety, which I think, we need a degree of it, but we do need the adventure, the challenge, the growth that comes with it. So it is a real tension and it's so much more beyond just what people do or don't want and how we've come to that, situation. And so that for me is Yeah, is something that I do think about is how do we initiate boys into adulthood? And I'm not a rites of passage, you know, person. I don't deliver in that space, but I read a lot about it and I'm fascinated by it and what has traditionally happened, especially in kind of non-white Western societies that have initiated boys into adulthood, into manhood, and what we've done prior to industrialized cultures that have created that. And I think that's also something that we like there's so many different facets to why we're seeing this, but I think that's also one of them is like the expectations, like, and people are talking about this like prolonged kind of infantilization that goes on in terms of taking responsibility. Now, I think the younger generation is extraordinarily bright. Like that's one of the things that I notice in my work is just like their insights and ability to integrate information because they're just, they have it at their disposal, but there is that other side of that kind of more character emotional maturity that is definitely seeming to be delayed. And it seems harsh, but you know, I do worry about, you know, guys who are still in their 30s spending like proportionately too much time, you know, video gaming or you know, on the internet. And I recognize everyone has different hobbies. I'm not against that, but it does strike me as something of like, is that contributing towards the good of those around you and your community? And we have seen this, and I know that's just me picking one example of it, but it, you know, people in years gone by just didn't have that much leisure time. I guess that's more my point. We have so much leisure time now, which I think tends to doing a lot of things that don't necessarily help our growth. It's kind of just social media, gaming, and just doing other things for fun, which is wonderful, but there is that sense of, do men actually need purpose and adventure? And I read something the other day that, like, you know, you wonder about this. Like, it was a quote that I just thought, wow, that says something really, really significant about in the context of like adventure and the need to dare and like what we're kind of holding back, our gifts, our talents, our strengths. And it all looks different. No person is the same. Like, not every bloke's an extrovert or an introvert. Some people are more adventurous. Some people are more academically inclined. But I still think, irrespective of what those gifts, talents, and disposition is, there is a sense to adventure, to dare, to go beyond. And that could be creatively, not just physically, you know, but it's like, what are we contributing? And I think that's the thing that I'm wanting to point to. And I love this story from like Ernest Shackleton, who explored the Antarctic, who was looking for volunteers for this expedition to the South Pole. And he published an ad in the London Times. This is how the story goes. And he just said, men wanted for hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in case of success. And it says that by the next day, there was 5,000 men lined up to volunteer.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. You know,
and I say that as not a non-adventurous kind of guy, you know, but I guess I feel like I have a fight in me for other things, you know, in terms of my advocacy and where I'm at. And so, yeah, I think it's tapping into that desire. Mm. Sorry to cut you off, Marie.
No, I love that ad. I've read that before and I just think it's fantastic. And there are so many things I've written down here. Risk muscle. I think we talked about this last time we spoke, but Celia Lashley, she's someone that did a huge amount of work in this space, and she talked about the risk muscle in young men, and that the, young men, if they don't experience risk and learn to assess, identify, and understand risk, when we let them go at 18, 20, 25, whatever the age is, that when they encounter risk for the first time, they generally become a cropper because they've never had to use their muscle, their risk muscle. And I see that now with kids, and I know that as a parent, having to break that maternal urge to let your baby go out into the world. Like, since we spoke last, Daniel, I've taught my sons to drive.
Right. How was that for you?
I'm covering the grey hair now, Daniel. that's how it is for me. But but you've got to do it.
I agree.
We all went through it. You've got to do it. It is an important rite of passage. And I've got to remember that I can, and you do the right things. You teach them, you put them through driving lessons, you do all of that.
That's right. You set them up for success to, I guess, minimize the hazards whilst taking the fact is there's still going to be risks. And I'm just going to, you know, be real. Like, I was a very anxious, risk-averse kid for many reasons to do with my upbringing, the dynamics at home, raised mostly by a single mum. So, like, I get it. So I'm not talking about any of the stuff that we've discussed as if, like, oh, my gosh, look at me. Like, I've... No way. Like, I have had to go on this journey and still on it of, yeah, being more open to taking risks in my business, in my advocacy, in the work that I do, and learning to, like, realize, yeah, you could fail. You know, you might have to dust yourself off or get it wrong or seek some feedback or get some advice. And I think, yeah, having that kind of muscle, that heart muscle, in the sense of, like, being able to bounce back, which is what resilience is, like, from, like, not getting it right the first time. And gosh, like, that has been a hard lesson for me, because in the end I just didn't dare, and it took me so long to get out of first gear in life because I was so risk averse and didn't want to go and take anything on. And so you've got that, which I think when we look at, like, the kind of virtue continuum where you've got courage down the middle, and then I think on you've got kind of like foolishness or kind of, you know, like going way too extreme on one side, and then you've got cowardice, which I tended way more towards, trying to find that really that good balance. Because I think when we don't channel in healthy ways, that's when we get boys, especially, and to hark back to the rites of passage language, like uninitiated boys trying to initiate boys into their pack. And it usually looks like some really extreme and dangerous, potentially gangs or violence or these sorts of things. And so to find a way that it's like, how do you, you know, channel your talents, your strengths for good, is, I think, the biggest task. And I think we've lost sight of it. And it's just a little provocation I always say at the end of, like, my staff PDs or parent community to say, like, I don't know what it looks like, and you can't cookie cutter it, because every young person is different. Like, I'm sure your sons are different in terms of there's some similarities, but there's some differences in how, like, we take them on a journey. And it's also not on just one adult, one great mom or dad to kind of get this right. It takes all of us to model that. And I think the biggest thing that I've just been advocating is we just need more men in the lives of young men. But someone brought up something recently that I saw, that because of the abuses of men in particular institutions over the years towards boys, and I'm wrestling with this, and maybe this is too, like, off the cuff for me to say it, but I think there's a bit of that passivity in men. They're a bit checked out. Plus, life is so busy, so it's hard to just attend to, you know, your own children, then let alone think about, you know, the kid down the street that might actually need a hand on his shoulder, an opportunity to, you know, come to the park or go camping or whatever it looks like with your kids, or, you know, but, like, Do men feel that they have the skills and the permissions to use their traits to help this next generation of boys who are just so desperately crying out for it? Like, so desperately.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, you, as you said, you're from a single parent family. And, you know, we see with a group of friends that we have here, one of the things that my husband and I are really conscious of is the fact that our stability as parents for our sons, because as our oldest son has got neurodivergence, so he's got autism and a whole bunch of other friends, he's chalk and cheese with his brother. 80% of marriages, if you have a neurodivergent child, end in divorce.
Yeah, wow, I didn't know that statistic.
That's a massive statistic. And that was something that when we discovered that, we thought, man, we do not want to be in that 80%. And now, like, when our son was diagnosed, it was 1 in 100 children were diagnosed with autism. Now it's 1 in 34. So that's one child in every single classroom which has got neurodiversity issues, which places a tremendous amount of stress on the system around them, but also too for themselves, because they're trying to find their navigation throughout the world. So it's really tough. So how do you unlock that hidden courage? You talked about courage in a midline, but I find so many boys have that courage, but they can't seem to access it. How do you access it?
Yeah, I think we have to give incremental opportunities to do that. So, like, there's things now that, yeah, like, I never would have done as my first step. But that's because That's your first step. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the whole, whether you want to call it an initiation, because it doesn't need to be as scandalous as heading to the bush and hunting, you know, a wild animal with a weapon that you've created yourself. But like, what are those incremental little challenges? And some of the people that I look up to and follow their writing and research say that that is actually the role of parental figures, to give their children just those little incremental challenges in different areas. And I think that is part of it. And because in that you then go, well, this new problem, like, I don't know how to do this exact new challenge, but I know I've solved other problems, and I should have some capacity to actually, you know, do this. And I think it's also like being there in the mistakes and like realizing that they're not fatal, especially if we can help a young person have a secure sense of self. Like, yeah, you are disappointed and you ruminate on, oh, that didn't go exactly as, like, I didn't play the game as well as I would, like, you know, whether it's a sporting game or, you know, like I had a recital and it wasn't as great as I'd hoped, but it's like, yeah, you still did it. And how do we bounce back from that? But yeah, I think finding out what those next kind of opportunities are, and you kind of see it more in smaller children when, like, you see them steadily climbing a tree higher or jumping into slightly deeper water in a pool, you know, like that's actually what it looks like. But it's like, I think it's easier to see in younger children. It's like, yeah, what does that look like proportionately for boys, you know, to put that next little stepping block there where they have to work it out themselves and dare. And so I think it is personality based. Like, I'm not someone who is very much interested in going camping and adventuring in that way. It's not to say I would never do it, but like, what are those things that I need to get out of my comfort zone about that, you know, I'm going to have to show courage in with regards to the things I care about. And so, yeah, I think that is the path. And I think that takes intention and time. And I think that's something we just probably don't do as well, is just like the intention and the time to actually think about this like well in advance in terms of like what that could actually look like for young people. I think schools are doing it. I know some parents are thinking about like marking different stages of their lives with certain things. But yeah, I think we just can't like be a hands-off approach and hope that that just naturally happens, because otherwise, as we've seen for boys, like they can just go and look up to more toxic influences who are telling them how it is because they say some things that resonate.
Mm. And failure too, you know, we have to accept that failure isn't necessarily a bad thing. And failure is part of life.
Totally.
You know, and so much now with kids. I mean, when I was a kid, competition was everything. Mm-hmm. And that's now at primary school level. It's everybody gets participation and there's no winners and losers, but life isn't that way. So it's difficult, you know, and I'm going to say something controversial now, but I really struggle with the over-feminization within education. And and you kind of alluded to that point before with men, you know, having those responsibilities and being able to be there to mentor our other young men. And when I was a kid, it was about a 50-50 mix between men and women in education. It's particularly in primary and formative education. There are so few men. They're just not.
I'm with you. I think in the US it's 93% female teachers for primary school. But yeah, we obviously have to look at the structural and social reasons why. I think, you know, it's all well and good to say we want more men, but, you know, do we pay primary school teachers enough? No. Do we shame men who perhaps want those more heel subjects? You know, how we've got STEM and then there's the health, education, arts. So, you know, do we actually encourage or nurture that? Because the sad thing is implicitly we kind of say that, like, that's not what men should be doing. And we wonder if, you know, all these happenstances have caused this. I was in a state school in Sydney recently, and at the end we were talking, and it's related to this exactly, about what are we going to champion in our school? What do we want more of? And, you know, a few of the girls said something really lovely. These were year sixes. And then a boy said something silly. But then the next boy, I said, so what do we want to champion more at our school? What do we want to see more of? And he just said, male teachers.
Yep.
That was so, and I spoke to the principal about it, and the principal said that him and one other staff member are the only two male staff out of 50-something at that school.
Yeah.
And so that is a huge challenge. And again, to have those touch points, I still remember, yeah, how formative some of the male teachers were in my life, and how we do that. And yeah, I think, yeah, around the feminization of schools, I mean, we'd have to define what we kind of mean by that. But one of the things I realize in my approach versus some other, you know, approaches that I see is like, I'm like wanting to set up our sessions when I'm in schools to be very playful, very interactive. Like, nobody's in trouble if they say, you know, the wrong thing or don't say it perfectly. But I do have firm boundaries, especially if boys want to tear each other down. Like, I'm not going to be easily offended, but I definitely want them to leave the room feeling respect for themselves. And I do wonder sometimes about, yeah, do we have enough firm boundaries for boys, because they are naturally wanting to test boundaries, and how do we like kind of hold to that, and how do we encourage them to respect those? And one of my concerns is they seem to respect me more than they would say like a female staff member putting in boundaries. And so what's the role that we all play in that? But I think the biggest issue is like seeing more boundaries for young men to actually know what is or isn't right, because that's where we do take so many of our cues.
And also empowering them at those boundaries as well. So, for example, as I said, teaching the kids how to drive. I mean, I've now got one that is of drinking age, you know, all those sorts of boundaries and responsibilities. How do we empower them? How do we sort of say, okay, yep. I mean, there are times that I've deliberately seen that one of my sons is going down a pathway, like safe with alcohol. I'm thinking, right, you know, do you think you should slow that down today, Tiger? Oh, I'm fine. And then we fall flat on our face, and you just let it settle. Let's deal with it now. Mm-hmm. Next morning. Yeah. How was the decision making matrix last night, my friend? You know, mm-hmm. And if I hadn't intervened, they would never have learned.
That's right. Then you're the one taking away his agency and his ability to make decisions on his behalf. And yeah, trying to find that sweet spot between, you know, how much do we guide versus giving responsibility. But I always have this approach, and it's like, this is my sessions. It's like, I go in wanting to give young people max freedom possible. Not like, you know, you get to leave, do what you want freedom, but it's like, I'm not going to, you know, be too controlling about all of this, but it then depends on your ability to manage freedom. And the reality is some people can't manage freedom well. And it's like, that's where you do have to intervene more. But my goal is that they would manage themselves well. It's why I like to get them to nominate their own captains to lead their small groups, to manage one another, rather than me having to be on them all the time. Because yeah, I think this is the biggest task. And that's what adulthood actually is. It's like, you now have more freedom, but what are the responsibilities that come with that? And has someone learned to put their own structures in place in their life so that they can handle the increased responsibilities and freedoms that come with that?
Sometimes I find that all of these, to get that message across, looking backwards is actually enables you to look forward. And what I mean by that is actually looking to figures in the past and in the history to actually teach us lessons of today. And I started watching actually a documentary last night on Winston Churchill, which has just come out on Netflix. Andrew Roberts, who is a historian, an incredible historian, British historian, and he is probably the leading Churchillian expert out there. I've only just watched the first episode so far, but I'm thinking, wow, every young man needs to watch this. Mm-hmm. Because it paints a picture of an imperfect man,
mm-hmm.
and who had great successes, great failures, more success, even more great failures, but went on to become one of the lasting, enduring figures of the 20th mm-hmm. century. And that's just episode one.
I love that. No, I agree. And we have so much to learn. I've got a couple of books staring at me now that are the lives of like generals in wars in history. And again, I'm a mostly pacifist, but believe in just war for those playing along at home. But like, there's so much to learn about what people did in such pivotal crunch moments, and how did they respond? How did they be aware of their strengths, be aware of their weaknesses, which is something I talk to young men about. Are you aware of both? Like, and you know, what did they do when confronted with difficulties or circumstances outside of their control? And yeah, again, I think there's so much to draw and learn from in terms of what's gone before us. And that's definitely something that, how do we, yeah, reimagine that in a current culture that's very what's happening right now, present, forward thinking, which is great. But yeah, to look back on the lessons of those that have gone before us is just so important in so many different contexts. I look at, yeah, both politicians, you know, activists, people, social reformers who have done so much. And yeah, they weren't perfect people. Like Martin Luther King Jr. wasn't a perfect person. Like so few actually were, you know, they had complex lives. Like I find, you know, looking at people like Alexander the Great and what made him so great, you know, and looking at his life and what he modeled. And again, take what you will of it. I'm more interested in the virtue and the character than, say, like triumphs in war and these sorts of things. But like, what made someone like that, and what can we learn from them and their kind of shortcomings as well? Because yeah, that's a great mirror and guide for us. And yeah, I think there's so much to be said about that, Marie, in terms of like, how do we translate that for ourselves and upcoming generations?
So looking forward now. So you go, hope you're going to get a break, Daniel.
Yes,
the summer.
Yes. Yes, that's happening eventually.
Excellent. Excellent. Yes. So what do you look forward to? What do you think the movement is going to be in 2025? So I personally, since we last spoke, across 2024, I certainly have started to see a shift away from sort of more critical social justice ideologies, and young men are now starting to find their own voices again. They're tapping into their positive masculinity. They're starting to embrace their natural strengths like leadership and their mateship. So 2025, what do you hope to see in 2025 with these kids moving forward?
Yeah, I'd love to see more of that taking leadership, because as I think you're probably alluding to, Marie, we know that boys have checked out a lot in the Western world. They have fallen behind and they're not ready, like they don't readily take on leadership, especially in a co-ed context. There's been so many schools where I've gone to where both head prefix were both female. And again, it's not to say it should be one way or another. At the end of the day, I actually think whoever's best suited for it, you know, should take on that leadership. But what I am hearing is that boys aren't putting their hands up. And I think that's something that we want to actually encourage and nurture. And I think an ability for them to bring their gifts and talents to the table, like that we actually need them to bring what they've got, their skills to the table. And that's certainly something that I try to do in every single session I have with a group of young people and young boys, is getting them to identify that and how they can contribute and be a positive influence, whether it's just to their best friend, to their family, to whoever, you know, or if they're the head boy of their school. And so, yeah, I'd love to see that. That's definitely my hope. I'd love to see more schools, whether they be co-ed or single sex, actually continuing to collaborate with one another to have all young people having these conversations, and not just theorizing, but actually demonstrating how we get together and treat each other with respect, with decency, humanize one another, and see themselves as in these challenges together, that there are certain things in our culture and in our world that they didn't create, but they are navigating. And so how can we ensure that we have empathy for one another and support each other through this? So I think that for me is what I'm optimistic about seeing. And one other thing that I've done a little bit this year is like doing lads and dads nights, where it's not just kick the footy or play cricket, which we do, and it's not just have a barbecue together, which we do. It's actually then sit down afterwards and talk about masculinity, relationships, virtue, who do we want to be, and seeing the boys sitting with their dads having these conversations and realizing, oh, adult men are doing this. Like, this should be normal. This is, yeah, we want to think about who we are, who we're becoming, how we're contributing to the lives and relationships around us. And for me, there seems to be more of an appetite for that. And I'd love to do more of that. Like, I think we have to connect the generations as well. You know, like, I think we can't just be like, having educators like me. Like, I love what I get to do, right? You know, and come in and speak to young people. But it's like, it needs to be holistic. And it's not to say that parents aren't doing that at home. They are. But how do we create more opportunities for this to happen so that boys don't just think, oh, it's just only my mum, Marie, who's talking to me about these things. But it's like, nah, there's mums and dads out there who are wanting to have these conversations with their young people and modeling it. So I think for me, that's like what I see as the next step and the real hope in this space. Is it's not just a conversation with me in isolation, tick that box at a school, but actually embedding this as like adults, men are invested in the lives of the next generation, especially boys, in lots of different ways. And that's just one way. There's lots of different ways. That's just one way that I've been really stirred about what's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And as parents, we've got to stop abrogating responsibility to the state. That is one of my absolute hobby horses, and I couldn't agree more. Look, Daniel, this has been such a joy. For people that want to engage with your content, just remind them again where they can find you.
Sure, they can find me on socials, but my website, danielprincipe.com.au.
Easy peasy, and we will make sure we have that in the show notes for everybody. It's been an utter joy to catch up with you again. I hope you get to have a few shrimps on the barbie and a few quiet ones over the summer.
And, yes, Marie, that would be lovely.
Yes,
that would be lovely.
Enjoy and chill. I'm a bit the same as well. I'm sort of looking down the tunnel of my summer break, and I can't wait. So I hope you do the same, and we'll catch up again next year. I know.
Sounds great. I'd love that. That'd be terrific.
Thank you, Daniel. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you. So connect with us today.